I think there has been no happier time in my theosophical career than these days here with you in Auckland. And I do want to thank you so very much for making this first visit to New Zealand and to your beautiful city such a memorable occasion. It is, as I say, I think one of the happiest experiences of the theosophical career that I've had, and a very beautiful prelude to my taking up work at our international headquarters at Adyar. I think your warmth and affection and welcome have just, made me feel that you won't mind if I return many times, and I have a feeling I'm going to turn up again and again. And if the president doesn't behave himself, I think I'll say, well, I think I can always go back to New Zealand. You see that there is a screen, and at the conclusion tonight, I would like to share with you a few slides that I happen to have with me, taking with me to Adyar, some pictures of the center at Alcott in the headquarters of the Theosophical Society in America. I happened to mention to Brian that I had these slides with me, and he persuaded me without much arm twisting. Of course, I'm always happy to exhibit the beauties of our center in the United States, hopefully in order that it will create more links with that center, with members throughout the world. But first, I'd like to share with you some thoughts as we are now on the eve of our centenary. We are about to enter the 100th year of the Theosophical Society. And I would like to share, therefore, some thoughts on this occasion with regard to the society today and tomorrow. I think it is useful from time to time for all of us to pause and to reevaluate for ourselves the purposes of the society. Why did we join the society? Why did you join? Why did I join? As members come and go, our perspective undoubtedly changes. And certainly we ourselves change in our perspective. We may have joined the society for a particular reason. We liked the people. It was a nice place to have a cup of tea. I remember in my graduate years in the University of Chicago, when I was resident, therefore, in Chicago, I belonged to a lodge of the society, and I joined that particular lodge because they did serve coffee and cake every Saturday afternoon. Now, this is a very, I'm confessing this to you, but I happened to be attending college and university graduate work during the Great Depression years and towards the end of the Great Depression years. And believe me, that coffee and cake on Saturday afternoon, which became then my supper for the evening meal, this was one free meal by paying my annual dues, you see. So one joins the society, one works in the society for many reasons. I could also tell you why I joined the society. It was a very interesting sort of thing, and it may recall why some people do join the society. Mary Kay Neff, who was a great international lecturer and worker, was speaking in the community in which I was attending university, and I had just met some of the members of the society. I'd been going to some of the young theosophist meetings, and they asked me to take the publicity table for Mary Kay Neff's lecture. Well, I fell in love with Mary Kay and thought, this is great. And the next night they asked me to do something else. And I thought, my heavens, if they're that hard up for workers, I'd better join them, you see. And so I've been working ever since. Well, we join the society for many reasons, don't we? People come in sort of out of the cold, if one can put it that way. There's a warmth, there's a fellowship. We join it because we may think that we are going to receive some kind of spiritual experience or some illumination, that we're going to get some understanding about some problem that has been puzzling us. But whatever our reasons for joining the society, I think it is inevitable that at any particular period in the society's history, the members then give the society a certain tone, a certain feeling, a certain note. Basically, in other words, the society is its membership at any particular period and takes its flavor, its rhythm, its entire direction from what the members of a particular time may give to it. If we, for example, have joined the society, as I say, for a particular purpose, we may impart that purpose to the society. In some subtle way, the society takes on the coloration of the purpose that we have brought to the movement. Now, in addition, I think we may say that beyond this, the society has objectives which are quite apart from its membership. The society as a vehicle, as a particular organization, as an organism, derives its objectives from a superior source, a source which is greater than its members can ever realize at any one particular time, and towards which, therefore, we are constantly moving or striving. Now, these two statements may seem mutually contradictory, but I think both of them are true. That is, that our purposes in the society are derived from the members, derived from those who are its members at any particular time, and at the same time, the purposes of the society are superior to, beyond the purposes given by the members, derived from sources beyond ourselves. In view of the times in which we live, which are exciting times, challenging times, in view of certain concepts which we may hold in a kind of tentative and open way, I think we need, therefore, right now, on the eve of the centenary of the society, to re-examine these questions with regard to the nature of the society. What is the Theosophical Society meant to do or to be in the world as it exists today? I might put it this way. I would like to propose to you that the society exists both in a temporal relationship to the world and in a non-temporal relationship. That, in other words, the society as it exists right now, in the world as it is in 1974 and 75, a very different world from 1875, or even from 1896, when the society faced its first and gravest crisis of division within its ranks, or even 1930 or 1950, or even 1960 or 70. The society as it exists today is in a world that is very different from the world of the past decade or 50 or even 100 years. At the same time, the society has another kind of existence which is non-temporal, which has nothing to do with time as such, that continues. It is exclusive of time and the passage of time, in the sense that the wisdom which the society exists to promulgate is beyond time, has a timeless quality. Now, I'm stressing these two aspects of the society's existence because of two statements made by H.P. Blavatsky in the early years of the society, which could seem to be contradictory, but which I think are in reality mutually supporting, and should give us pause to consider the society as it exists today, as it will exist tomorrow, both in its changing aspect and in its changeless aspect. First, the very often quoted passage which occurs at the conclusion of The Key to Theosophy regarding the society's future. There, H.P.B. said, with regard to the society, that its future will depend almost entirely upon the degree of selflessness, earnestness, devotion, and last but not least, on the amount of knowledge and wisdom possessed by those members on whom it will fall to carry on the work and to direct the society after the death of the founders. This places the responsibility for the society clearly on our shoulders, doesn't it? Depends on the earnestness, the devotion, the knowledge, the wisdom that we, its members, possess. And as we look at ourselves, we realize how little we know. How many times in your theosophical career have other engagements, other interests come before the Theosophical Society? A good television program, so why go to a meeting tonight, and so on. How many times have other interests come first? I mean, let's be honest about it. This isn't to say that other interests may not need to supersede this at times. But just look at it. Here is this statement that the future of the society depends on these things. The selflessness. How selfless are we, really? Are we willing to risk all? Now, at the other side of the coin is a statement that is, I think, lesser known, but appears in a most remarkable document written by H.P.B. in answer to two very severe critics of the society. And the document became known, therefore, as the original program of the Theosophical Society, an article that I think really ought to be required reading of every member of the society, every new member at least, if there were such a thing as required reading. And in that amazing document, setting forth very clearly the basis on which the society was organized, written by the one individual who knew precisely what she was doing and who was acting as the direct mediator between the adept world of the occult hierarchy and the world of human beings, mortal men and women. In that remarkable document occurs these words: the Theosophical Society cannot be destroyed as a body. It is not in the power of either founders or their critics, and neither friend nor enemy can ruin that which is doomed to exist, all the blunders of its leaders notwithstanding. That's very hopeful, isn't it? That's extremely hopeful, all the blunders of its leaders notwithstanding. That which was generated through and founded by the High Masters, and under their authority, if not their instruction, must and will live. The vehicle of Theosophy will stand indestructible and undestroyed by the hand of whether man or fiend. Now, here are two statements. One that says that the whole future of the Theosophical Society depends upon its members. The other saying that the Theosophical Society will endure in spite of its members. And indeed, as we read the history, as I frequently have said, as we read the history, it does seem more often than not true that the society has managed to endure in spite of its members, not always because of them. So how are these two statements to be reconciled? I suggest that it is only if we perceive the temporal and the non-temporal objectives which the society serves. The temporal objectives take their rise from the membership at any particular period. We can move the society, as it were, into specific areas of activity, into specific emphases that we feel are important to give to this teaching or that teaching, this doctrine or that doctrine. We, for example, you and I, at the present moment, are responsible right now for the present temporal objectives of the society. How the society shall be known. What is its image in the world? What can it accomplish? How effective can the society be in meeting human needs? How effective can it be in awakening a new consciousness among humanity? We are responsible. Whether the society exists to do this or that work in the world today, and there are certainly voices, as you must be well aware, in New Zealand, as we certainly are in the United States, as I've heard them in Europe, in South America, wherever I have traveled, voices who cry out that the society should go in this direction or in that direction, that we should be a propaganda agency, that we should do this, we should have orphanages, we should be the savior of humanity in this direction or in that direction, leading crusades for truth or an educational institution, whatever. Many of the ideas very good. I'm not decrying them, but merely saying that there are a multitude of voices, each one shouting the direction in which we should move. Now, how do we distinguish among these voices? I think by looking, if we can, as clearly as possible, at what I have chosen to call the non-temporal objectives. That is to say, those objectives which take their rise in a superior order of reality, which is ever-existent, which may be modified to meet the needs of a particular time, but which in themselves stand above time. For this order of reality pertains to an interior wisdom that is above, untouched by the transience of facts and objective knowledge. You may say you're making an artificial distinction. You're straining at something that does not exist. A distinction that is meaningless so far as our actual work is concerned. But I feel it is very important for us as individual members to examine very, very clearly this distinction between the objectives of the immediate present and those superior objectives which ever obtain, regardless of what conditions may demand of us in a particular period in history. For ultimately, really, it is only as we glimpse the reality of this superior order of objectives, in some measure the non-temporal objectives, that we can align the temporal objectives to the true purpose of the society in a meaningful way, and therefore chart the direction of the society into the future. In other words, I would like to suggest that it is only as each one of us, in his commitment as a member of the society, aligns himself inwardly with the immortal purposes for which this body exists. To the extent that we, of course, become capable of perceiving those immortal purposes, that we are enabled to recognize what may be at any particular time the special emphasis that is needed in the world. Now, how do we do this, of course? This is the big question, isn't it? How do I align myself inwardly? I may say, I see such and such an immortal principle, and you say, I see another immortal purpose. We may say, yes, the society today must move in this or that direction because of the immortal purpose that I perceive, while you, with equal validity, may say, but here is the essential purpose, here is the abiding purpose, so the society must do that. Well, there must be some common basis then of perception, or the society would have ceased long ago to exist outwardly, even if its existence had continued inwardly. So I do not think it is enough to say that this common basis of perception has simply arisen because a majority of members have acted in a certain way at a particular time, or because certain great leaders have moved among us and have informed us, given expression to certain ideas. And we may feel that the great leaders are no longer with us. The heyday of the society under such a magnificent leader as Annie Besant, for example. Where are the leaders today? Indeed, where are the leaders in the world today? I think it is because today we're on this threshold of a new type of leadership, which is the toughest kind of all. It is no longer the excellent individual that rises among us, but there must be called forth the excellence in every individual. Leadership must be taken mutually by all. And this is a new experiment in which we are no longer told, but have to discover within ourselves that alignment which alone informs us so that we become our own leaders, as it were. Well, I suggest it is this common basis of perception that can be arrived at if we are willing to take, therefore, a larger view of the matter. Not a circumscribed view, not the society in any limited sense, but looking at the whole theosophical movement from above or from within, from inner spiritual levels. Can we see the entire theosophical movement, which is to say, not only the society, but the entire movement? And you remember in one of the wonderful letters from one of the adept teachers to Mr. A.P. Sinnott, the statement is made, there is far more to this movement than you have yet an inkling of. A very thought-provoking statement. Can we gain a large enough point of view by looking at the entire movement and attempting to see how we can align ourselves with that purpose for which the movement exists? Let me just give you a clue, as it seems to me we have been given in some of the writings. In the anthropogenesis section of the Secret Doctrine, as you may be well aware, there are presented to us the various stages in the development of consciousness. Unfortunately for our modern usage of the term, and because no other word was available at that time to adequately express this evolutionary development, the word race was introduced, root races. I say unfortunately because it has come to be abused and misunderstood as having reference to ethnic groups, which is very clear that it does not refer to ethnic groups if one really looks at all of the material given to us in the teachings, both in the secret doctrine and in the Mahatma letters, but rather has to do with certain major evolutionary stages through which human consciousness moves. And the key to it all is that there is an evolution, a tripartite evolution, as we have been told, monadic or spiritual, mental or monastic, and physical or biological. It is all a matter, really, essentially, of an evolution in consciousness, a breakthrough in consciousness, which is the unifying link which enables, which forces, first of all, forces physical evolution to move forward and enables spiritual unfoldment, the monadic unfoldment, to manifest itself in the great creative powers, which are beautifully hinted at in the third object of the society. Again, I feel so much misunderstood as having to do with powers that are merely psychic in nature, powers latent in man, which are not the powers latent in man, but the powers that are of the animal. And so I think we misread our third object and stress powers latent when we ought to stress man. For if we know what man truly is, if we really know what is man, then the powers that are latent are the deific powers. And this is hinted at again and again throughout our literature. Now, in the whole evolutionary development, known as the great root races, therefore, or the advances in consciousness, HPB makes the remarkable statement that with each advance, each one of the root races, another sense is developed. And this you can follow, of course. Those of you who are students of the secret doctrine are very familiar with this, naturally. Now, as we come to the period when the next great breakthrough in consciousness is about to take place, and as I have said on previous occasion this week, it seems to me the Theosophical Society was founded in the last century in order that it would be here now to provide the medium through which this breakthrough can be channeled, if we will. The statement is made in the secret doctrine that the next great breakthrough, known as the sixth root race, has more to do with psychology than with physics. A most amazing statement, because where is the battle drawn today? Where are the battle lines in human consciousness? The battle lines are in this very realm of the psyche, in the exploration of psychology. The true understanding, which one of the adept teachers said to Mr. Sinnott, we offer to exhume for you if you wish. The nature of human consciousness. I think one of the most dramatic evidences of this is the statement which opens the UNESCO Charter. Since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be built. A very far-reaching statement, and one of the most dramatic evidences that the breakthrough that is to come at this new age, as we move into the final quarter of this century, many looking for a teacher to appear, you know, and just someone to guide us, someone to lead us on, Where is the great one to be born? And all of this, instead of looking within to the birth in every human being and bringing to birth within himself that new consciousness which is the world teacher manifest in each individual. This is the possibility. And we who are the inheritors of a legacy of wisdom, the Theosophia of the ages, can align ourselves with that inner purpose if we will. The hints have all been given to us. All there, if we but read aright, it seems to me. So first there must arise this, the time has come for a unification in human thought, both as represented in human knowledge and in human behavior. For now there is no excuse for us if we do not live out what we know. The Pseudo-Dionysius put it, you must not only learn the truth, you must suffer it. We must live out what we know. And if we do not do this, we who have the privilege of being members of the Theosophical Society, we will have missed, I think, the greatest opportunity of all our incarnations. It is this 20th century incarnation that is the real opportunity of all lives. What karmic privilege brought us into incarnation at this time? Can we miss the opportunity? It is tremendous. First, bringing about a realization of that one true relationship which must obtain among all peoples and which must obtain within ourselves the relationship of brotherhood, which has been expressed through our first object. A relationship that first of all must take place within ourselves. In other words, we can scarcely be brothers to others if we are in conflict within. If our own nature is not of a brotherly nature, how can we express brotherhood? The realization must come from within. And then one acts in that manner. One moves in that manner. It would be impossible to do anything else but be brotherly. Second, a unification in thought, for which our second object has been beautifully formulated. A unification in thought of the religious, the philosophical, and the scientific attitudes that give us a broad spectrum of understanding. And finally, a realization of the spiritual unity of all mankind, subject to universal law and order, perceptible to an awakened consciousness, unity at the spiritual center, which is the point, I think, to which the third object is oriented. So the whole purpose of our movement, then, is ideally a creative purpose, to create a new humanity by creating a new consciousness, by providing the fertile ground for the seeds of a new consciousness to take root and emerge and flower among us, a spiritual consciousness, or at least a consciousness that will possess a certain spiritual quality. These, I suggest, if one looks at it closely, constitute the immortal purposes for which this movement exists. And therefore it is that this society can never be destroyed, because there will always be that organism in which will be nurtured and given opportunities for growth, those men and women who are ready to risk all for the sake of knowing truth and living it. And at the same time, the external society will always depend on the manner in which we who are its members have taken hold of these truths and have made them evidenced in our lives, have given them witness before the world, speaking, as the Quakers put it, to the condition of man at every moment. For the movement that was launched by and through HPB, by her adept teachers, proclaimed first principles, and it is these to which we may align ourselves through our studies. The Theosophical Synthesis and Explanation of Things finds both intuitive and practical confirmation through independent thought. We must come to it for ourselves. Test the principles in life. I remember a number of years ago a friend of mine telephoning me one day and saying, "Joy, do you believe in reincarnation?" And I was so taken aback, I said, well, of course I do. And she said, "Well, I just wanted to know why you don't live as though you did." I said, "What do you mean?" And she said, "You act as though it all had to be done in this incarnation." Well, why don't we trust in the law, for example? You know, we go around so often. Well, let me put it this way. Somebody comes to you with a problem. He's in deep distress, you know. And we immediately search around for what to say. And we think, ah, theosophy has the answer. Of course, theosophy has no answers. People have answers. Theosophy provides keys. But only you have the answer. So you search around, you know, and you think, ah, karma. It's his karma. And then we go about like a batch of parrots. "It's your karma, it's your karma, it's your karma." You say, "This is like parrots. This is what we do, isn't it?" You say, "It's your karma, it's your karma." And that's all we can say. And of course, then if something happens to us, you know, if something goes wrong, sorrow enters our life, sadness, we're frustrated. "Oh, it's the fault of somebody else. It's the fault of my parents. It's the fault of I didn't get an education. It was the depression. It was this. It was that. It was the other," you know. And we think of karma as neat little blocks, quantum blocks that hit us on the head periodically, you know, all neatly tied up. If we do something that's fine, if we do something that's brilliant, do we say it's my karma? No, we say, "Well, you see how fine I was. I managed that all right. I came through that. It shows I have strength of character and moral courage," and so on. If something goes wrong, it's karma, you say. Instead of realizing the universal law, law which is operative as the harmonics of the universe at every moment. Trust the law, as Clara Codd has always so beautifully said and wrote a little book with that title. Do we trust the law? No, we don't. No, we're always interfering somehow. You know, we feel we have to hasten things along. We have to bat people on the head, you know. "Join the Theosophical Society or you won't be saved. Liberation," you know. And so we carry St. Christopher medals around us just in case the Theosophical Society won't get us into Devachan. So we want to be sure we're guarded on all sides, as it were, you see. But do we really trust the law? Do we really live as though reincarnation were true? live not by postponing into a future incarnation, because that is not what reincarnation is all about, but living in a cyclic, harmonious manner, living in what I call, I have a marvelous name for it, someday I'm going to achieve this, rhythmic laziness. That sound good? Rhythmic laziness. We move and we permit the law to take place, to manifest. In this mind age, which is our present age, the development appointed can take place only in an atmosphere of freedom. And what the mind can do with freedom has been demonstrated, of course, in the achievements of science. And we talk in the Theosophical Society about freedom, freedom of thought. But what is true freedom? If we do not live in accordance with the law, moving in this rhythmic manner, can we know freedom? You cannot have freedom of thought in a mind that is bound by prejudice, bound by anxiety, bound by anticipation, bound by frustration, bound by all of the multitude of things that keep our minds fettered. Can you be free to think if the mind is fettered? Only the mind that is free can think freely and investigate independently. Freedom results, therefore, from a mind that is in tune with the universe, with universals, with the unity of all life. And in tune with law, in which there is lawfulness, freedom then is not license, but perfect order. And one becomes the disciple of the law, disciplined from within, not subject to external authority, but inwardly disciplined. This is, I think, that what is needed, that freedom from passion, freedom from the instincts and all of the pressures that influence and subordinate the mind. And so the way is pointed to us here in the Theosophical Society to that kind of freedom which arises only in the true and perfect relationship, the ideal relationship, the one true relationship, which is brotherhood, which is love. The dynamics of freedom are love, are brotherhood. And so if we can begin to realize that, we begin to see this immortal purpose within our society that there can be nurtured and brought to birth a united humanity, a unification of thought at all levels, a unification that leads us to transform our concepts into action that is pure, not reaction, but action that acts, that simply acts because it acts out of the relationship of brotherhood, out of a constant awareness of the unity underlying that relationship, an action that is the theosophical life made manifest at every moment, in how we put a postage stamp on a letter, in how we walk down the street, in how we greet each other, in how we smile, how we stand, how we talk. Without action, there is, of course, no completeness, no fulfillment, and therefore no realization. For we always act what we know. If we are fearful, it is because we know fear. And fear is but the shadow of faith. It is the dark side of an absolute confidence in the law. And so the society, I think, will continue to flourish because there will always be in it those who are committed to this kind of movement towards the wisdom and towards living the wisdom. There will always be those in it who will recognize, it seems to me, that the essential task begins with the self but never ends with the self. For beginning with the self, it can only end in that greater self of which the smaller self is a part. It can only begin where I am. The first step must begin here, it must begin now. HPB pointed out that she began a leavening process, that her job, the task of the society and her work was to leaven the minds of the times. And that leavening process must still continue. She did not, she said, set out to convert the world, but merely to leaven the minds of the times. I think we may share her purpose and her vision as we continue to contribute to this change. The work of our second century is going to be even more demanding than the work that has yet been done in this first century. It will demand not less than all, and it will not demand huge numbers, but it will demand the commitment of each one who is numbered among its members, the full and undivided attention to bring about a change which is first of all inner, as I have suggested, and that has to do with a way of life, a mode of behavior, a way of walking and talking, as well as a way of thought. It is not necessary, I think, as part of this, to find demonstrations of direct connection between things that are happening in the world and the theosophical teachings, although this may be useful. For the prime message and the important message concerns the high potentialities of all human beings. Can we look at each other and draw the best out of each other, so that an awakening to the powers of independent thinking, a shedding of prejudices and traditional limitations are all seen to be aspects of the theosophical movement. Indeed, anything which is a vindication of the human spirit is a vindication of theosophy. And I have often thought that theosophy is in the world not so much to spiritualize humanity as to humanize humanity. For once we are truly human, we will be spiritual. Once we have discovered our own humanity, the powers latent in man, be human and you will be divine. I think sometimes we overleap what it is to be truly human. We have scarcely discovered what it is to be human. We're content to be animals most of the time, selfish, petty, greedy, argumentative. We have yet to discover where lies our humanity. And so the role of the theosophical movement and the line of transmission of its teachings will always impose upon us a responsibility to work for the transformation of attitudes with as much self-consciousness as possible. For it is given to students to grasp what is going on. A part of the great historical process of psycho-moral or monastic evolution, and to add to it the peculiar illumination which self-consciousness makes possible. There will always be those who join in this self-conscious effort, who will represent not only the beneficiaries of the leavening process, but the fellowship of companions who undertake to extend its effects. I think this is what we can really do if we will. This is the possibility that lies before us. The possibility that we can really transform ourselves and transform the world. The world needs new laws, new cultures, new institutions. And theosophy contains the possibility of bringing about new ideas which will cause the materialization of these new cultures. I think if we can see that the major fetters, the main fetters, are really all within ourselves, not in anyone else, not in a society that would seem to bind us, but in the possibility that we can discover here and now that which we truly are. Observe, for example, how closely the three objects of the society are related to the first three fetters on the path of holiness. The delusion of self is dissipated by the practice of brotherhood, which arises out of a realization of unity. Do we really know that relationship? Doubt and uncertainty are removed by study, and superstition is effaced by the investigation of the laws of nature in their visible effects and invisible causes. In the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna reveals to his disciple Arjuna what is called his supreme yoga, the sovereign yoga, the revelation that he, as the universal emanating principle, underlies all activities, all manifestation. And after this stunning revelation to Arjuna, Arjuna, who earlier has said, "Yes, I know this is all very well and good. You've given me a lot of philosophy. Now just tell me what I'm to do," you know, the age-old cry of the disciple, "just get on with it and tell me what I am to do." And to whom Krishna had already responded, and this is my own translation of the Gita, I hope you won't mind. Krishna comes back and says, "Arjuna, my boy, you're on your own." That's not Dr. Besson's translation, I understand. And this is always the answer of the teacher to the would-be disciple. You're on your own. And so following this magnificent revelation of the sovereign yoga of the Lord, Sri Krishna, as the unmanifest principle underlying all manifestation, Sri Krishna then says to Arjuna, "Be thou the outward cause." And I think this is the cry, the call to every one of us today, members of this Theosophical Society, the most magnificent movement on this planet, the one organization, adept founded, adept inspired, and still, I am convinced, adept directed. We who are members of this have the clear duty, be thou the outward cause, the cause that can bring about that effect which has long ago been foretold, the realization here on this planet of brotherhood, of peace, of world understanding. And that is the challenge, I believe, my fellow members, as we enter our second century. be thou the outward cause. So thank you again for letting me come and share these ideas. We'll be working together, and I hope that we can serve together, you here, I at Adyar, or wherever. And one day, if you will, if you'll let me, I'll be back to see you. Now.